The FIFA Women's World Cup is going to kick off on the 20th of July. It was, of course, this time last year that we were watching and cheering on the England team to that amazing Euros victory. Well, one woman who played a huge part in that journey and was also sat as a fan at Wembley to cheer on that Chloe Kelly goal is Jane Purdon, who has now turned her journey into a new book called The Homecoming. And we can speak to her now. Evening, Jane.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
How has the book tour been going?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been great, actually. Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of a newbie at this because it's the first book I've published, so I've learned an awful lot. The nicest thing is going into bookstores and meeting people who've bought it and read it and have come along to say hi and talking to readers and getting their feedback on it. That's been absolutely wonderful.
Did you get the idea of the book before the success, or was it immediately afterwards that you were encouraged to write this book?
No, it was afterwards. It was very, very soon afterwards. Now, the backstory here is that my publisher, Ian Ridley, I'd worked with him before with the organisation Women in Football, who I do a lot of work with, and I was the CEO until a couple of years ago. And he, in a previous project, had had the idea to get more women writing about football, and we published a book called Football She Wrote, which was an anthology, and that did really well, and it was very groundbreaking. And I think it was the week after the Euros final, Ian and I both independently had the thought, we've got to write a book about this. And I had that thought and sort of mentally made a note. And then a couple of days later, Ian rang me. And he just said to me, Jane, we've got to write a book about this. And I was absolutely delighted because I think it was such a special summer and special tournament, a home Euros, to see England win at a home Euros, that I really wanted to record it and capture it, not just the matches, but how we all felt as fans and how the nation came together and sat up and took notice of this incredible Lionesses team. And joined in the delight and triumph when they won.
Absolutely. And as you say, Ian, a huge supporter of women in sport, and his wife, Vicky, was at the forefront of that, wasn't she?
She was, and she was a board member of Women in Football until very sadly she passed away a few years ago. And Ian, I sometimes think about Vicky and I think about Ian, bloody hell, Vicky, I hope you forgive me saying this, you trained him well, because he totally gets it. You know, he's such a wonderful, what we call, male ally, doing all he can to promote women and celebrate women in sport and women as sports journalists and sports writers. And when I tell him this, he always refuses to take the compliment and says it's what Vicky would have wanted. It's what Vicky would have wanted. And so in some ways, this book is a little bit of a tribute to her as well.
Definitely. Yeah, a wonderful woman, actually. Great smile and always a sort of somebody who was great to chat to in a press box whenever you were lucky enough to work alongside her. Okay, so you start the book, you're sat alone on a bench, and you're just kind of trying to clear your brain after what you described as a bit of a mental sort of overload. Do you recall that moment?
Oh, yes, I do. There's a little bench. It's not far from our house, and it's just an ordinary bench. And sometimes when things are just getting on top of me a bit, I just go and sit there for a moment of calm. And this was the day before the final. It was Saturday, the 30th of July. And having worked in football for 20 odd years, mostly in male professional football, but having been a fan of women's football through all that time, and while I worked in the men's game, you know, sort of on the side, always kept an eye on what the women were up to, I just knew how much was at stake the next day. And I honestly, I found it very difficult just to keep calm and manage the emotions. And I got some good advice. My partner is a very sort of down to earth, and he's very good for me in that way. You know, when I sort of told him, he said, just relax. Don't worry about things you can't control. I was like, oh yeah, that's good advice. And I managed it for about 10 minutes, you know. So I just took myself away to have a good think. And what I really was thinking about was, I thought the next day we would be at Wembley And I was worried I'd just be totally overcome by emotions, whether we won or whether we lost. And I thought the best thing to do was to try and rehearse some of that sitting on the bench. You know, how am I going to feel if we win? How am I going to feel if we lose? And as part of that, I started rehearsing my own personal history in the game and just going through it all and just reliving my personal journey, which is, you know, been one of 5 decades. I mean, you know, since I was a little girl, my dad first took me to football, just so that I could kind of practice it now and I wouldn't be overwhelmed by it all when final whistle came around.
Yeah, how did that go? you were calm and collected, I'm sure, weren't you?
No, I mean, actually, to an extent it worked, just thinking through things calmly, thinking about the journey and my journey, the lioness's journey, and just having a little bit of practice of, if we lose, this is how I'm going to feel, if we win, this is how I'm going to feel, did help. But I have to tell you, the next day, on the Sunday, I was still in a total state, you know. Weirdly, the men's football season kicked off that day, and in the morning, my team, Sunderland, were playing Coventry in the EFL in the Championship, and they were selected for Sky. So we had this sort of weird experience of watching Sunderland v Coventry open their season at 12 o'clock before we headed off to Wembley later in the afternoon. And I remember watching that game and just watching it but not watching it. You know, it was like it was just happening on a different planet because my head was so elsewhere. And I'm such an uber Sunderland fan, and Sunderland had just got promoted back into the Championship. That's quite rare for me. But no, I was in quite a state all day, really.
Before we talk all the way towards that Chloe Kelly goal and whipping off her shirt, let's take you back to, as you say, the start of your journey. You mentioned Sunderland there, and that love of football started with your dad, didn't it? And
yes.
with Sunderland. And I think at one stage you kind of saying to your dad, can I come along to a game? And him
yes.
being him sort of being, I guess, slightly surprised but equally thoroughly pleased with the fact that
yes.
that you were showing an interest.
Yes, so wind back to 1973, 50 years ago, when I was 7, Sunderland won the FA Cup, and that was a major deal, and particularly because Sunderland were in the equivalent of the Championship. They were in the second tier, and they beat Leeds, who were probably the best team in England. It was one of the biggest cup upsets of all time, and I watched it on TV, and as I describe in the book, having never been particularly interested in football before, the moment when Ian Porterfield scored for Sunderland, I just fell truly, madly, deeply in love. And I fell in love with football, and I fell in love with Sunderland Football Club. And here I am 50 years later. And, you know, sometimes that love affair has driven me up the wall. Sometimes it's given me utter joy and delight, but I cannot break it and I cannot walk away from it. So going back to that game, I did ask my dad. He took my brother, who's older than me, to Roker Park. But I said to him, can I come too? And I'm so grateful because my dad, I think he probably was surprised. But the thing is, he was totally non-judgmental. He just said yes straight away. There wasn't any sort of feeling around that it was unusual or a bit odd or even comedy for a girl to ask to go to football. And I loved it. I mean, you know, I loved it from my first match there. I loved the football. I loved the experience of being in the crowd. I loved people watching, actually. I loved people watching the crowd and seeing how they reacted with the joy when it went well and the despair and gloom when it didn't go so well.
One sentence that really stood out to me in the book, football is quite simply the greatest and most enjoyable game it is possible to play. It isn't even debated. It's a statement of fact.
Well, I guess that's me, because I have tried lots of sports. And of course, I'm of the generation where at school we couldn't play it. We played netball, which I enjoyed, hockey, which I didn't. And I now think is sorry to all the hockey devotees out there. I now think hockey is just football played with a bent back. I'm like, what is that about? Sorry, it's not for me.
And some very bruised ankles, I think.
Yeah. I played rounders. I played a bit of tennis. Those were the kind of girls' sports. And I didn't actually get to play football till I was 19 and went to university. And by this point, a couple of things happened. Firstly, a friend of mine had gone to university the year before, and she'd taken up rugby. And she said to me, "Jane, university is a brilliant time to take up a new sport." And that was really sound advice. And the second thing was that in my gap year, and we're in 1985 at this point, I'd been to the USA and had been staggered by how popular girls' soccer, as they call it, was there. You know, every high school had a team. And this really put kind of iron in my soul and fire inside me. I thought, I'm going to play football. And I remember it, Emma, the first time I played, it was a revelation. I thought, this is just brilliant. It feels brilliant. It's a brilliant thing to do. And I was never much good, and that's not false modesty. You know, that's me being a very cool-headed, that I was given a little bit of sporting ability, but not much. But I absolutely adored playing it. And I still think it is just the greatest game to play, because it's really simple in a way. Just a group of people and a ball and two goals, that's all you need. But there's enough of bits of everything. You know, there is a bit of strategy and tactics in it, but not enough to overwhelm it. When you play it, there's absolutely room for personal flair. That's critical. But it's also a team game, and you have to play as a team. So I think it kind of packages everything that a sport can ask of human beings and of human beings in a group, but in exactly the right balance. And I just still find it wonderful to play.
And you quite enjoy being aggressive, didn't you? Permission to be
Well,
aggressive.
permission to be aggressive. I talk in the book about this. I've used the word assertive rather than aggressive. But for me, this was a revelation at the age of 19. And as a woman, when you go out onto that football pitch, you have to be. You have to be. That's within the laws of the game. I don't mean being a player who commits fouls or plays dirty, but you have to tackle. You have to try and, if an opponent's running towards you, get round them, not just give up and say and be nice and go, "There you are, the ball is yours." And the fact that this was expected, again, I found just a revelation, because I think for my generation, and maybe it's still the case now for young women, even though feminism had done an awful lot to change the world, it was still the case that whenever we expressed anger, aggressiveness, that was disapproved of, you know? Still a bit of a thing kicking around in culture and expected behaviour of women that you'd be nice and you'd be polite. And if you wanted something, you might have to ask for it in a roundabout way rather than very directly. And so again, it had this huge impact on me, not just kind of physically, that I'd finally landed on a sport I absolutely adored physically, you know, as a way of keeping fit, but sort of psychosocially, you know, it is fine. It is fine to run at a player and try and get round her or try and get the ball off her, you know, and even if accidentally she falls over, it's still fine, you know. So yeah, very powerful lesson to learn.
Definitely. I think a lot of the journalists who followed women's football for an awfully long time, particularly when those new fans were finding the women's game during the European Championships, I think there was a certain sort of attitude of, oh, isn't it lovely that they're just all playing the game and everything, and that they're playing it in the right spirit, and well done for them for just getting involved. And other people going, actually, maybe you want to watch Katie McKay play one day, and you'll see how the women's game gets played. Don't worry about it. Your personal journey, as you say, this absolute love of football, and I'm sure you were hoping that you would always find a way of finding a job within the sports, but you were a Cambridge-educated lawyer.
And by the time I'm kind of launching into the world and it's time to do some proper adulting, you know, it's about 30 years ago. It's the early 1990s. And I did do a bit of activism around women's football, and I actually set up a fanzine called Born Kicking, which ran for four issues and never sold very much, Emma, but I had fun doing it. But frankly, I couldn't find a way to earn a living from women's football back then. It did exist. There was a new national league. You know, the National League started at around that time in the early 90s, the forerunner of the WSL. The England team was there and actually playing some great football. Went to see them a few times. But I never thought that I'd be able to make a career in football or somehow monetize all this passion I had for the women's game. So I went off to become a very kind of ordinary and boring lawyer. And I thought that's that. And I'll keep watching Sunderland and I'll keep playing when I can. Although, again, at that time for recreational players like me, it's very hard to find a team. In fact, it was impossible. I just had to set them up, you know, when at my university, at my postgrad university, at the first place I worked, the only way for me to play football was to set up a team. So I kind of thought I'd hung up my boots, you know, and I'd had a few years just being a very conventional lawyer doing litigation, and that was that. But then
until Sunderland or a friend of yours said,
a friend of
yeah.
mine, yeah. So this was in 2001, and a friend of mine who'd worked with me in one of the law firms where I worked, and she called me one day and said, Sunderland Football Club are looking for a club secretary. They want someone with a legal background and you should apply. And I did that thing which I think a lot of us would do, you know, a little bit of maybe imposter syndrome, and I just went, I'll never get that job. You know, what are you thinking? I don't do football law, you know? But she was very good. She just persuaded me, nagged me actually, to apply. And it's one of the things I often tell younger women now, like on the Women in Football Leadership course that I lecture on. So you need a good friend like that, someone who's worked with you, but also knows you as a friend, because in some ways they can audit you better than you can audit yourself. And they can see things about you and things that might suit you that for whatever reason, you've got a blind spot about. So I applied for this job and I honestly thought maybe I'll get an interview, you know, maybe I'll get a tour of the Stadium of Light, the ground that Sunderland had moved to, and I'll get a few dinner party stories out of it. Well, here I am 22 years later, having worked for Sunderland for 4 years and then gone on to work elsewhere in the game. So that's how it came about. And I'm grateful to my friend. I'm also grateful to the then chairman, Sir Bob Murray, who took a chance on me. Because, you know, I didn't have any football law experience, but again, he must have seen something and he recruited me, and I will be forever grateful to him for giving me my break. Another great example of male allyship.
I think you said that he particularly liked working with women.
Yeah, he often said that he liked having women on the board of his businesses because he had other businesses apart from the football club. He liked having them in the leadership because he said they bring something different to it. And he walked the walk on that one. He did have women on his board at the football club. He did have women in very senior positions. And basically what he was doing was something that we now all accept is the right way for businesses to be run, which is you build diverse leadership and build diverse management. And since then, you know, there's been studies done by the Harvard Business School or whoever, showing that when you have diverse leadership, diverse boards, companies perform better. And Bob had got there on his own experience as a very, very successful businessman. So, yeah, as I say, another fantastic male ally, not just to me, but to many of the women who worked at the club.
So you worked for Sunderland as a club secretary, went from there to work with the Premier League. What was the attitude towards you as a woman in football? Did you feel that you were a woman in football, or did you feel that you were just working within the world of football?
I have to say that throughout my career, on balance, my gender has not been an issue on balance. I have met it. I have met sexism from time to time. And, you know, I know how corrosive it can be. As I've explained, I think I lucked out at the football club. I know our research at Women in Football tells us, when we survey our members who work across the football industry, that the vast majority of them have experienced sexism. And we know that while the industry is changing, and it is, it still has a lot of work to do. So You know, I've sometimes encountered it, and you have to think what to do, take it on, or I would say go through it or go around it. You know, those are your two choices. But I wouldn't want anyone to think the football industry is, the people who work in it are is institutionally sexist, because I don't think it is. But I said this to someone recently, a woman, quite a high profile woman who works in football. She really pulled me up on it, and she'd had some dreadful experiences. But I think particularly on social media, but also from some of the people that she worked with, and I totally respect that. It's a mixed picture out there. It's a mixed picture out there. So as I say, football is changing and wants to change, because women in football, we work with organizations across the industry, you know, with leading Premier League clubs, with governing bodies. And we know from talking to them, when they go and recruit, they just want to recruit the best people. They don't care if they're men, women, black, white, they don't care. But sometimes they need a little bit of help just to make sure that's the story that they're telling about themselves in order to attract people in.
So let's go return to your England journey, your journey following the England women's football team. A nice Sunderland connection as well, really, with a lot of the players, I'm sure, that were in that team that you were starting to watch more closely.
I think I used the phrase in the book that for us Mackems, Sunderland fans, with the England women's team, we've had something of a golden generation. And I think it was the 2019 World Cup semi-final where six of the England starting 11 were from the northeast of England and had passed through Sunderland's books at some point. And I do keep saying this to people, to journalists, to people who work at the FA, and people who want to find an interesting subject for a PhD in women's football. I say, go and find out what the hell Sunderland were doing 20 years ago
What was in the water?
to produce Lucy Bronze and Jill Scott and Steph Horton and Carly Telford and Lucy Stanford, etc., and Beth Mead as well, etc., etc. And I think one of the things was that they were doing right was, again, it goes back to our chairman, Sir Bob Murray. One of the things he was passionate about was the Sunderland Community Foundation, called the Foundation of Light. And he made sure that that was very well supported and was able to deliver fantastic programmes. And of course, back in the day, a lot of women's and girls' football sat within club community foundations like the Foundation of Light. But for me, you know, it was wonderful. That generation is sort of tailing off and getting a little bit old now and retiring. We're just seeing, I think there's just Lucy Bronze in the current World Cup squad. Beth Mead would have been there, but she's injured. But for me, over the past kind of 12 years, since I seriously started going to watch England again, it's just been fantastic, you know, to go to the World Cup in France and like, you know, the pitch is full of lasses from the northeast. It's been great, you know. And it's also why I understand when women from other areas or other kind of different ethnic backgrounds to me, when they say representation matters, I totally get that, because I've had this privilege of watching all these wonderful Sunderland women grace the England shirt for a decade.
Yeah, absolutely. Then England get to host a major tournament, and you had said before, did you say at that at what stage did you decide that England were going to win it?
Well, this is quite astonishing, because I go back to this fanzine, Born Kicking, that I did in the early 90s. And I wrote a little bit for some of the other fanzines, particularly when Saturday comes. And you know what? The whole lot was sitting in the loft, I mean, until Ian asked me to write this book. And I thought, I better get it down, reread all this for the first time in 30 years. And I think someone nudged me and said, do you remember writing this article in When Saturday Comes 30 years ago, where you said England England women's team could one day win the Euros. And my jaw dropped, but there it was. And I had said it. I also said, at the same time, I said, Barclays should sponsor the new National League, you know, and here we are. You know? So I was like, yeah, okay, Jane, what's the lottery numbers? You know, I couldn't believe this kind of mystic Meg ability that I seem to have. But I think there's a serious point in there, because I knew back in the early 90s, the quality I was seeing on the pitch. They were fantastic, that team. And when the rest, I was like, I got quite frustrated, because I was like, why isn't the rest of the country watching this team, which had, you know, Hope Powell, Marianne Spacey, Kerry Davis, Jill Coulthard, wonderful players. I knew the quality that I was watching. And really, all through my journey of supporting the England women's team, they've been good. I think the team we saw last summer was exceptional. But they've always been a skillful, stylish, highly competitive team in all the tournaments where we've gone to watch them.
One important change, one important improvement has been the amount of investment in the women's game and also the amount of coverage. You know, I spent 10 minutes earlier on in the show this evening chatting about the fact that Alessia Russo was moving from Manchester United to Arsenal. I can't imagine that. I mean, I personally would have done that, but I'm just sort of thinking, you know, whether or not that story would have hit so hard a few years ago.
Yes, I think you are absolutely right. And I've been an eyewitness, and the book tells some of this story, to watching that grow and grow. Even in 2011, when me and my other half went to the Women's World Cup in Germany as fans, we just went as fans. It was barely covered in this country. I think maybe, in fairness, one or two papers had journalists out there. But I mean, we were out there watching the England games, but I think, I'm not sure the England games, group stage games, were actually shown on TV here, or if they were, they were sort of lurking somewhere on the red button. So I've seen it also. I mean, you know, back in the day in the 90s, a lot of people thought it was just a joke. And a lot of people in what we now call the mainstream media, you know, high profile male writers, just kind of sneered at it and laughed at it. And I've watched all that change. It gives me such joy, you know, that young girls growing up today, for them, it's going to be normal. And young boys as well. They're going to see their schoolmates play at school. They're going to see their sisters play. And we've got a generation growing up who just think it's normal. Of course, both sexes play football. And that's absolutely wonderful. But it's been a long road to get here. And a lot of people, many of them, far more than me, you know, let me say I've done a modest, small amount, but many people have worked tirelessly to get us where we are today. It really has been a long struggle. And I'm delighted for them. You know, friends of mine who've worked at the FA through the past 20 years, tirelessly building and building women's football. They deserve huge credit, and I'm delighted that they were able to have their Wembley moment last July as well.
And it was great that a lot of the players recognised that too, didn't they? I think Jill Scott saying, all of your hands are on this trophy.
Yes.
Leah Williamson immediately sort of saying, look, this needs to be the start of something. I think those players recognised that they were standing on the shoulders of others, but that they were also creating a lasting, or hoping to create a lasting legacy themselves.
Yes, and you see the older players amongst them. Now, I think I'm right in this. I know Jill Scott's agent quite well, and I must ask her to fact check this, but I have a vague memory of the Sunderland women's team that I think Jill would have played in, packing the bags at Asda in a place called Bolden Colliery, which is a suburb of Sunderland, to raise money for their team bus. You know?
That sounds like a plausible story, definitely.
You know, if it wasn't Jill, it was this, the older ones of this current generation, that's where they started, and they will remember those days very clearly. And like me, they've witnessed the journey from that to full professionalisation, and the top clubs and their country giving them all the support they need as elite athletes. The point being, Emma, that I think all of them have, as all of us who've been involved in the women's game have, a sense of mission. and a sense of the struggle, a sense of the journey, a moment of celebration that, as I say, it's kind of happening now, and maybe in 5-10 years time we won't need to have any more conversations about the struggle and the journey. But I like this team because they are mindful of others. And I think I make the point in the book, you know, when you're an England player, man or woman, you get extensive media training. You talk how to speak to the media and what things to say, and be very, sometimes you see that, you know, men's and women's players saying, like, if they're congratulated on a game when they're being interviewed, say, oh, well, it was a good team effort, you know. But I think a lot of what the Lionesses do is absolutely authentic and genuine and from their hearts, like Jill thanking everyone who'd helped on the journey, like the day after the final, the entire team wrote to the then prime ministerial candidate saying, now make this available for every girl, the day after, you know. And fair play to the government, they've stepped up and said they will. But yes, I think we have a sort of cadre of players who know it's not just about them.
Yeah, absolutely. Great role models. And as you say, more than happy to say what they want to say when they get the opportunity, which is brilliant, really. So the book obviously is about your journey towards last summer's European Championships and sort of during the course of England's journey all the way to that final. You approach this slightly pessimistically. Yeah. Is that what you're like as a football fan? Because I'm the same, because it means you're never disappointed.
Yeah. Yes, and I'm like utter doom and gloom, whether it's Sunderland, my club, or whether it's England, my country. I am utter doom and gloom that everything's going to turn to a very rude word, which I won't say on the radio. And that is absolutely the kind of fan I am, you know. And if you think back to England's first game, it was actually quite nervy. They won, but it was 1-0. They didn't set the world alight. And then all the other kind of contenders, the clubs who you thought, well, they're the countries, sorry, who you think, well, they're surely going to be up there in the semi-finals, the finals. So France, Germany, they, in their opening games, you know, they were winning them 4-5-0. And I was like, well, yeah, that's, of course, we won't do that, blah, 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 you know. So it's the eternal dilemma of being a football fan. It's I find it absolute unbearable agony sometimes, you know. It's the hope I can't stand. It's that expectation. But I can't stop doing it, and I wouldn't want to stop doing it for a moment.
No, I think the game against Spain, you're in a meeting. It was on a phone somewhere. You were trying to keep... And you kind of, at one stage, had decided that England had lost.
Yes. Yeah, so I was in a meeting, and it was with some people who I hadn't seen in person for a year, some of them ever, because of COVID. It was an organisation I do some work with in men's football. So when we were scheduling this off-site, two-day off-site, it had to take place then because of the demands of the men's football calendar. And I was cool with that, even though I thought, well, I'll not be able to go to the quarter-final. But we were in some really nice hotel somewhere, and I'd thought beforehand, they're bound to have a TV in the bar, like everywhere has a TV in the bar. But no. So over dinner, we were sort of watching it on someone's phone. But it was really difficult for me, Emma, because I wanted to talk to these people, because I hadn't seen them for so long. And every time I sort of looked down at the phone, I think the great commentator, Robin Cowan, was, you could hear the sort of slight anguish in her voice, because Spain were pressing and Spain were playing that beautiful carousel passing game they play, and England were really under pressure. And in the end, I think the last time I looked at the phone, England were losing 1-0. And that was sort of about halfway through the second half. And I just thought, I've got to turn the phone off. I've just got to turn it off, because that's going to be a whole load of emotion for me if they lose, which it looks like they're going to. And I don't want that to spoil this evening with these people. So we finished dinner. And it was only when I was walking back to my room about 11 o'clock at night, and I switched the phone back on and saw they'd actually won it. And they'd equalised in the 84th minute and then scored the winner in extra time. And I did that thing, which I do a lot at football. If you read the book, you'll know this. I burst into tears.
Aww. So, okay, so we get to the final. We, I say we. There is the final, and you could have been sort of sat in the posh seats, couldn't you, with a prawn sandwich? But you go there as a fan, which is quite fortunate because it allows you to take a flag and to dress up as who exactly?
Millie Bright.
There we go.
Millie Bright. No one invited me to the posh seats, actually, which I'm totally cool about. I know, but I'm totally cool about that. That's fine. We bought our tickets the year before, and it was literally 12 months before when the tickets came out. We got two tickets for the final. Ridiculously cheap, Emma. I can't remember what we paid. 25 quid each or even £50 each would have been cheap for the scale and wonder of that event. My friend and her husband, they also bought some tickets, and I said to her, this is sort of fighting talk, and I didn't really mean it, you know, it's just the kind of rash, stupid thing you say. I said, right, if we get to the final, I'm wearing a Millie Bright wig. And she laughed. Millie Bright, for those of you who don't know her, she does her hair up in this when she's playing in this sort of big top knot that sits on top, and it never moves throughout the game. You know, a lot of the players, they sort of have to redo their ponytails and fiddle with their hair bands, but Millie Bright's hair is, you know, it just doesn't budge an inch through the game. And for some reason, it just caught my imagination. I think it's a great look. You know, I think it's a really great look. So fast forward to the day of the final, and these two friends of ours came round to our house to go to Wembley with us. And my friend is sort of, my friends are both of them sort of giggling. And we're like, what's up? Something's clearly up. And then my friend Helen just produces this wig, which is the best recreation of Millie Bright's hair you'll ever see. Apparently, she told me it took her hours to sort of buy the wig and do it all up with hair clips. But I am a woman of my word. And when she said, when I'd said a year ago, if we get to the final, I'm wearing a Millie Bright wig, I am wearing a Millie Bright wig. So we took it. But for me, and I did wear it, but we all had goes at wearing it, but I did wear it. But for me, it was a chance to kind of kick back and not be in the posh seats, you know, to do daft things like wear a stupid wig and wave our flag and join in the singing and shout my damn head off. That was one thing, you know, don't do in the posh seats, but absolutely shout my damn head off.
Jane, I will come back to you because I've got a lot more to chat to you about, but we're just going to pop briefly to Wimbledon, if that's all right, because we have had some British success. Josh, Cam Norrie is through to the next round.
He is. He's won it by 3-1. It's been a really entertaining game as well, especially the final set. Every game going almost down to the wire until Norrie managed to break Thomas Marshak late on in the set. It looked like it was going to be plain sailing for Norrie after the third. He won that one 6-1, and Marshak seemed to be struggling with a wrist injury. However, Marshak came back in the final set to make it a real thriller in the first round. We do have some more action on centre court. Quentin Hales and the British number 2, Dan Evans, have made their way back out. Their game was suspended due to the weather earlier. Dan Evans has got some work to do, though, if he's going to get through to the second round. He trails by 2 sets to love after losing 6-2, 6-3. So it seems as though Evans has got a mountain to climb if he's going to get back and into the second round of Wimbledon.
Thank you very much, Josh. Josh, keeping an eye on things in SW19 today. And, of course, we will be back at Wimbledon over the course of the fortnight. Hopefully it gets a bit more sunny. Returning to our chat with Jane. And, Jane, we obviously, you know, spoiler alert, England are going to beat Germany in the end. But it's interesting to go back to you sitting on that bench the day before. And you said earlier in our conversation you were thinking about what was at stake.
Yes.
In that final. How important was that Chloe Kelly goal, do you think?
Huge. It was a goal that, as I often describe it, the earth took a little judder on its axis and was never the same again. Nothing will be the same again. Football won't be. Something changed, and it changed for good. And we knew, you know, those of us who work in football, we knew that it was... there was the future of an entire sport at stake, or an entire edition of a sport. And that's a lot more than is normally at stake in a football match, even a major final. But we knew that if the England team did well, they would light up the nation. They would inspire young girls and women. And frankly, actually, I mean, women of all ages to go and enjoy this game as players and as fans, and men too. Men are super important in all of this, and so many men enjoy watching the Lionesses and became fans of the England team as well. We knew that it would unlock interest from fans, political interest, commercial interest, broadcaster interest. We knew it would be transformational. So as I say in the book, you know, so only a little bit riding on this game then, and that's an awful lot for a team of 11 fairly young women to bear on their shoulders. But I think that the England camp did an excellent job, and Serena Wiegmann, the manager, and her team did an excellent job on keeping the players absolutely focused and absolutely on track with the job they had to do, and just focusing on playing the football and on playing the football alone.
Yeah, what a brilliant appointment she was.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
And of course, the famous image of Chloe Kelly whipping off her shirt. And I think some people sort of had memories of Brandi Chastain, but although I think she was trying to replicate Bobby Zamora, wasn't she?
I don't know. She's not come out and said, I think it was Beth Mead in her autobiography said that of course, Chloe's a QPR fan, and she wanted to kind of try and channel Bobby Zamora, who scored this really late goal for QPR in the playoff final a few years ago. But it's an iconic, it's an absolutely iconic thing for a woman to do, a sportswoman to do. And I find it powerful for a couple of reasons. Firstly, there is a young woman running around a football pitch in her bra, but we're not looking at her as a sexual object. We're looking at her as a really powerful athlete, as an incredible player who's just scored what's going to turn out to be the winning goal to put her country at the top of Europe. And that is a different way of seeing women. And that's this other thing that I think women's football and all women's sport does. It kind of disrupts how we think of women's bodies, and primarily through the centuries, we've all, as women, been very conscious about how attractive am I? You know, I've got to wear makeup, I've got to dress in a certain way. And that, to a certain extent, that's innate, and we want to do that, and that's fine. But women's sport offers us a whole new relationship with our bodies as athletes, and our bodies as things that can run and kick and score incredible goals. But I think I say in the book, the thing I find really moving about that image is actually when you look at her shorts and her socks, they're covered in green grass stains and brown mud stains, you know, from where she's been tackled, she's fallen over, or she's tackled, or she's slid in to get the ball. And to me, that tells a story of such hard work on the pitch that day. You know, it wasn't easy for her, and it wasn't easy for any of those players. They had to play to their absolute utmost, and that I do again find very, very moving, very moving image.
And there were a few tears, were there not?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny,
you weren't the only one.
Yeah, I at that moment I was again just kind of, when she scored, my taken to, it was like I was going to a different planet. I felt like I was lifting off my seat and rising out of Wembley, was going to a different planet. And I think I say in the book, you know, stop all the clocks, England, oh England, 2-1, here we are. It was just an incredible moment. And do you know what, Emma, when the final whistle came, I kind of sat down and waited for all those emotions that I'd rehearsed the day before to come, and they didn't. I just thought, said to myself, don't be so bloody ridiculous, and stood up, and It's Coming Home was playing, and I just joined in singing It's Coming Home, high as a kite. Wonderful. One of the best sort of football days, probably the best football day I've had, actually. It's an absolutely wonderful moment.
You, in the fifth chapter of your book, ask the question, how do we nourish and build the game? You've spoken already about women, our body images. You talk in that chapter about, you know, eating disorders. I think Alessia Russo, I was reading an article of hers in Women's Health, talking about how she's learnt that she doesn't want to be skinny. She wants to have a strong body. And, you know, she is a young woman who is a role model. Anxiety, depression as well. These are all big issues, aren't they, that still need to be addressed, and not just within women's sport.
Yeah, I totally agree. And while I do think women's sport does kind of give us the opportunity to reset our relationship with our bodies, there are some real sort of pressures and some bad stuff in there. You know, if we turn up the stone, what are we going to find underneath? So I talk in the book about how some academics this time last year done a survey of top elite players in this country, and some disturbingly high numbers had revealed eating disorder symptoms and other mental health issues. Anecdotally, some former players have said to me, oh yeah, when I played we had something called fat club, you know, and the amount of fat in your bodies was measured, and if it was above a certain amount you were frankly shamed. And I'm like, but we women, we have fat, we have more fat than men, that's the way we're made. And while of course I want to see these wonderful athletes to reach the full potential of their ability as sportswomen, I want that to be within healthy parameters. And again, I think sport, women's sport and women's football maybe has a bit of a way to go to make sure that that's the case, that we owe it to these players, these wonderful players, not just in football. You know, next summer we'll see Team GB competing in Paris and all these wonderful athletes. We owe it to them to make sure that their experience of elite sport is a positive one and that they are safe and they are healthy. We absolutely owe it to them. And I've come to believe this with a passion. But I think we do have a bit of work to do.
And as far as football is concerned, are we reaching the conclusion of this Karen Carney-led review? Do you think we're at a point where we're going to find out the conclusions of that in the near future?
I think they've said they're going to publish in the summer, and it's the summer now.
Yeah.
So that's all I can say.
Okay, because I know you've had a little role in that. I'm just I could talk to you all evening, but obviously we're running out of time. So I need to talk to you about what's going to be, well, kicking off in the Southern Hemisphere in just, yes, a few weeks' time. Are you going to get the opportunity to travel to Australia or New Zealand? Are you going to be able to see any of the games live, or are you going to be sort of turning on a television at 6 o'clock in the morning here?
Yeah, turning on the TV, I think. If they do well and get through, we may go out, but certainly for the group stage, turning on the TV, watching it here. And I'm fine with that. You know, women in football, we've got some nice events lined up, some kind of watch parties, breakfast parties to watch the games. And it'll be great, you know. So really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a really exciting tournament. The Lionesses team are going to be different from the one we saw last year because some players have retired, some are injured. But there's some exciting new talent coming through as well. So I'm not quite sure what we're going to see. You know, it's going to be different, but very exciting. And great to see some of the other countries as well, and countries we don't often get to see. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing China, who are in England's group, to see what's, because we just don't know, because again, it doesn't really get the coverage, what has been happening to women's football in China over the past 4 years. But China being China, you can bet that the government have invested in it. So, you know, let's see who rocks up. Very exciting.
Definitely. And there are all sorts of things happening still in women's football, as you talk about in the book, what's happening, what has been happening in America, what's happening at the moment in Spain, for example, and in, yeah, France. We haven't really got the time, unfortunately, yeah, now to talk about that. But I mean, it was interesting, like one of the, we spoke to Beth Mead about her new book recently, obviously a player who's injured at the moment, and her attitude, yeah, was, yes, I'm missing, but isn't it a wonderful opportunity for another player?
Yeah.
To take that up, you know, to take that chance to perform at a World Cup, which is a brilliant attitude, I think.
Yeah. Yes. Poor old Beth. We all miss her, you know. But listen, England is, no disrespect to Beth, we all wish she was there, but England is not short of good striking talent. And I think personally about this England team, that's one of the things I'm most excited to see. You know, Alessia Russo, Rachel Daly, who played left back for us last summer,
I know,
is now playing up front, and she's owned the WSL this season. She's on fire. She won the Golden Boot. She won Player of the Season. I just think it's her time. So hurry back, Beth, because everyone misses you. She's a really nice person. But I'm sure England's still going to get a lot of goals.
Definitely. And yeah, Beth has had a tough time. Obviously, be really sad not to see Leah Williamson there either. Fran Kirby. There will be important players who are missing. It is the world stage rather than the European stage. But still, it's going to be so exciting to see what England can achieve, isn't it?
I think so. I'm excited to see Rachel Daly up front for England, if that's the option Serena goes with. I'm also excited to see Lauren James, young player, Reese's sister. But I always say that because I always think, how proud must you be if you're Mr. and Mrs. James right now?
Oh, yeah.
You
know? And he's a proud brother, isn't he? He's always sat in the stands watching her. So, yeah, and she has been brilliant as well. So just quickly, before I let you go, I'm sorry. Is there another book, do you think, beckoning if there is success this summer?
Watch this space. I've got a few plans kicking around.
Fantastic. I will look forward to it, and I will look forward to finding out which wig you're wearing of the options.
Well, I'm open to suggestions. People can suggest to me on Twitter, and I'm a woman of my word. I'll do it. Tell me a wig to wear and I'll do it.
You are a woman of your word and a woman full of predictions as well. So one way or another, lovely to speak to you, Jane, and I'm sure you're very humble about these things, but you have been a hugely important part of what the England women's team are doing now, even if you don't think you have been. So thank you so much for everything you've done for women in football, and long may it continue. Really appreciate speaking to you this evening. A lovely hour in the company of Jane Pun. Her book is called The Homecoming, and it is her story, really, her personal journey as a woman who just loves football, has loved football since just discovering it as a girl, supporting it, playing the sport as well, but also being really part of the organisation, part of the infrastructure, and part of the changes that have been made and continue to be made in order to see the success that we are now seeing at a national level and at a club level as well. So lovely to speak to her this evening. Of course, the Women's World Cup does get underway later this month in Australia and New Zealand.